coverage in the United Kingdom of the extraterrestrial UFO issue has exploded over the past 12 months. And it's due to the timed release of the thousands of documents and sighting reports by the British government into the public domain.
These releases have generated hundreds of articles both in the UK and the United Kingdom. Our next speaker has been at the center of this storm. He is a former senior executive officer with the UK Ministry of Defense who directly investigated the UFO issue while working for the MOD and is now leading a leading researcher and spokesperson.
Last year, he accomplished what only one or two others have accomplished during the 62 years of the UFO exopolitical era. His op-ed editorial on this subject matter was published in the editorial section of the New York Times.
Our speaker will be joined today by Dr. Milton Torres, Major, United States Air Force, retired. As a result of actions by the British government regarding classified files, Dr. Torres was thrust into the media spotlight last year. His story is as extraordinary as was his willingness to tell it like it is to the media when they came calling.
Please welcome Nick Pope and Dr. Milton Torres to X Conference 2009.
Well, thank you very much indeed for that. Thank you, Steve, Cheryl. Thanks to all the PRG staffers, benefactors. Thanks to Frankie Ma from Sky Channel 200 for moral support. And thanks to Milton Torres, who will be taking the podium after I've perhaps set the scene a little bit. I'm going to speak for maybe about 20 minutes or so, explain the background to the release of the Ministry of Defense's UFO files, then hand over to Dr. Torres. He'll speak firsthand about what I think you'll find is one of the most interesting and sensational UFO incidents that you will have heard about. And then Dr. Torres will hand back to myself. I'm going to talk about some other UK-related developments. And then Steve has asked that we try and leave some time for questions, because I think there will be some questions on Dr. Torres's extraordinary encounter and on the amazing situation that is unfolding in the UK at present. I want to start, people talk about disclosure. I guess that prompts the question, well, what is there to disclose? All I can say is that as somebody who served for 21 years at the British government's Ministry of Defense, our equivalent of your DOD, of course, the best perception I have is that absolutely everything that we have on the UFO issue is being placed into the public domain on a rolling program. I'm going to get into the whys and the whats a little bit later on. I'm going to roll this back to December 2007. I don't really want to do anything older than that, because I want to keep this presentation really quite fresh and current. And there is even, at the end of this talk, going to be quite a bit of new developments from this year. This is an ongoing, unfolding situation that is attracting media interest from all around the world. December 2007, the Ministry of Defense made a policy decision to release its entire archive of UFO files. 12,000 sighting reports going back to the 50s, policy files, files on how to handle this subject when it's raised in Parliament or by the media, public correspondence files, all sorts of files. Why was this decision taken? Three main reasons. Reason number one, the French government had recently disclosed their archive of UFO files. CNES, the French National Space Research Institute, has custody of the UFO issue in France, but they had made a decision to release their files. Some of you may have seen, unfortunately, the story was overshadowed by one of those unfortunate things which took the edge off it. So many people tried to log on to the website that it crashed. An indication, though, of the phenomenal public and media interest in this subject. But the French government disclosed, and that set a precedent which made it more difficult for us in the UK to hold out on this. The other reason, the second reason, is that the Ministry of Defence felt, and the government felt in a wider sense, that this would be an interesting issue on which to demonstrate the government's commitment to open government and freedom of information. The third reason is, I think, the most interesting one. The Ministry of Defence receives more FOI requests on UFOs than any other single subject, including the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. There is immense interest in this subject in the UK, immense pressure on the government, and of course the workload involved in responding to these Freedom of Information Act requests on a case-by-case basis was intolerable. And the flip side, the downside of that, is that the people doing now the job that I was doing in the early 90s are spending so much time on responding to these FOI requests that they're having very little time to do anything which could be remotely categorized as meaningful in terms of investigation or research into the phenomenon. I think that's a serious issue. So, for all those reasons, in December 2007, the MOD made that policy decision. We are going to release the whole lot. It's going to take 3 years. It's being done in a number of different batches because, of course, there do have to be redactions. Sometimes that's quite understandable things, names and addresses of witnesses under data protection and privacy laws, of course, can't be released to the public. But there are other things too, the capabilities of a military radar system, methods and sources of gathering information passed in confidence by an ally, all those sorts of things. So it's a big job. Some poor person, and I actually know him, he's the guy doing the job I did, has to go through all this page by page, line by line, word by word, redact it, scan it in, black it out, etc., etc. So, December 2007, the decision was taken. May 2008, the first batch of files was released. I had a peripheral role in this, even though I'd actually left the Ministry of Defence in 2006, but the National Archives, who are basically now going to be the custodians of this material, called me in and asked me to review the material, as indeed, of course, I'd worked on it, to help them pick out some cases, some serious, some quirky, some explained, some unexplained. So they had me do that. And they just generally had me in a sort of consultancy role, as it were, and also asked me, as I now act, actually as a freelance journalist, and I'm going to get into a little stuff, incidentally, about UFOs and the media later on. But they called me back. The file release was a huge success. It made every single national daily newspaper in the United Kingdom. Serious news shows, chat shows, documentaries, 2 million downloads within a couple of months, even after you had to pay a few dollars to get your hands on these things. It's very sneaky. They're free for the first month, and then they start charging you a few dollars. Well, government's a bit short of money at the moment. Some interesting highlights. Again, time doesn't allow me to go through this in huge detail. Much of the files, many of the reports, of course, are pretty mundane fare. Some more interesting cases. April 1984, a UFO seen in a suburb of London. Two women call the police. The police turn up, and instead of saying, what are you doing, wasting our time? The police actually see the UFO as well. They have it under observation for about 45 minutes, an hour. They look at it with the naked eye, then binoculars, and they start taking sketches. September 1985, two UFOs tracked on military radar, 10 nautical miles in 12 seconds. Pretty interesting. September 1986, a UFO passes an estimated 1.5 nautical miles from a commercial aircraft. The pilot submits a report to say, I have no idea what this thing is. Maybe it was space debris re-entering the Earth's atmosphere and breaking up. Maybe it was a meteor or a fireball. Or maybe it was a missile that had been fired on. And he said, if the latter option, my crew and I are extremely displeased. Second batch of files were released in October 2008. Some interesting material in there. A case from 1990, where a UFO was photographed over Scotland. A large diamond-shaped metallic craft hovering very close above the ground. Very long story that I don't really have time to go into, but that picture was assessed by the Defense Intelligence staff and other MOD specialists tasked with photographic interpretation. Their assessment was this photo is not a hoax, it's a real object, it's about 25 meters in diameter, and we'd sure as heck like to know what it is. Because, of course, the reason that the MOD is interested in this is basically, is there something we can learn about the capabilities of these things, whatever they are, whoever or whatever is flying them? And let me make one thing clear. I don't know what UFOs are. I'm not standing here as someone who's saying to you that UFOs are extraterrestrial and this is part of a process to disclose. I don't know. I did that. I worked in the MOD for 21 years, 3 years on the UFO project. I still don't know what these things are. What I do know is I think they raise important and interesting defense, national security, and air safety issues, but I am not somebody who knows about some smoking gun, some spaceship in a hangar somewhere. If there is something like that, they didn't tell me. So, some interesting cases in this second batch. As I say, this photograph was assessed as real, and of course, like I say, we're interested in things like aerodynamics, propulsion system. Is there something here that we can learn from and incorporate into our own technology, whatever these things are, secret prototype aircraft or something more exotic? We honestly didn't know. So there was that case. The photograph, by the way, the conspiracy theorists do like this because the photograph was on my office wall for about 2 years. Then my skeptical head of division convinced himself that this was a secret American aircraft that we shouldn't know about. And he took this picture down and locked it away in his desk drawer. And when information about this came out, and in fact there were a couple of mainstream media articles about this just in the last 2 or 3 weeks, the picture has disappeared. So I suspect it just got either put through the shredder by a very nervous person who convinced himself that this was something we shouldn't be seeing, or it genuinely got lost. These things happen, actually. I know people read all sorts of sinister things into these sorts of things, but having worked for a bureaucracy for 21 years, I've lost files. I've put a file out on the desk, put another file on top of it, I've closed it up, put it away, and thought, where the heck did that go? And 3 months later, I find it where it shouldn't be. These things happen. So we're going through this second batch. April 1991, an Alitalia jet coming in to the UK over Kent 22,000 feet, suddenly something flashes so close to the UFO, to the aircraft, that the pilot shouts, "Look out, look out." Again, whatever you think UFOs are, I think it's incidents like that. And these, of course, by the way, this is not just my say-so. You can go to the National Archives website, you can go to the Ministry of Defense website, you can read these files, you can see these cases for yourselves. This isn't hearsay evidence. This is actually the material that the government and the military are themselves releasing. So the media are kind of flicking through this second batch, and as I said, there are some interesting cases, but you know, most of it is pretty mundane. So they're going through, and it's man walking his dog, sees light in the sky. Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Woman looking out of her window, sees a green light streak across the heavens. Yeah, okay, that's fine. United States Air Force pilot ordered to open fire and shoot down a UFO. Yeah, what? Hello? So the media is going through this, and suddenly, this case leaps out at everyone, and they go, what? This is in the material that the Ministry of Defense is releasing? And on that note, because there's no point my telling someone else's story, when you people have a fantastic opportunity in one of these rare, rare events in this subject to hear about one of the world's most sensational and interesting UFO cases, not, and no disrespect to the researchers and the ufologists and the journalists, but not from somebody else writing up somebody else's story, but from the man himself. My co-speaker today, Dr. Milton Torres, a retired USAF major, 20 years service for his country, doctorate in mechanical engineering, taught at Florida International University, a man who has served his country with distinction and honor, who has not particularly wanted, because he was asked not to talk about this, and it was only when the Ministry of Defense effectively outed him and put his name into the public domain that you know, we're in a situation where, okay, if the government is now releasing this and it's in the file, I guess I can talk about this. So without any further ado from myself, I would like now to hand over to Major Milton Torres.
You want me to pin that on?
I thought you should be okay there.
Okay. I hope you can hear me. This man just saved my life. The MOD released the story that I've kept since 1957. What a relief. I can talk about it. I'll give you a background about where I came from and how I started. I joined the Air Force because the Korean War was on and my number was getting close. And I certainly didn't want to go to the Army, and I don't like mud. And I just sure as hell wanted to be a fire pilot, and I knew I wasn't going to be one because I didn't have any education at that time. But anyway, I joined the Air Force, and lo and behold, they come down and say, we offer to the enlisted personnel a chance to fly. Wow. You couldn't give me more money or more grace than to be a fighter pilot, and I wanted to be a fighter pilot. Well, when I got into fighters, or I should say when I got into training, I decided I was going to go for the fighters. I wanted to fly an F-86 and go to Korea and shoot down all those goddamn MiGs that everybody else was missing. Anyway, make a long story short, I succeeded. I was well up in the top of the class. I wasn't the top, but I was close. And they offered me a fighter job. It was an F-86, but an F-86 not for Korea. It was an 86D, an all-weather airplane to shoot down bombers that were coming in. Well, at the same time, high-level discussions were held in the Air Force, and they said, we're going to send this F-86D to England. We're going to augment their defense capabilities just in case. So they took an entire wing. A wing consists of basically three squadrons of fighters. That's about 75 fighters. And they sent me to England, RAF Station Manston. And boy, that was a great, great thing. I had been watching J. Arthur Rank movies since I was a kid. And I knew that I was going to love England. So there I go. So I was afraid to go to England and meet some of those old spinsters that the J. Arthur Rank used to put up for movies. And so I said, I better get married. So I married my bride, and that was way back in 1954. Excuse me. Yes, 54 is when I married her. I also went to England in 54. They sent me directly to England with my wife. At any rate, one of the things that I can say, when I went to England, it was just exactly the way they described it in J. Arthur Rank. I mean, I was issued currency that was pounds and sterling, and some of them were printed on only one side in black, a five-pound note. And everybody that I go to cash this five-pound note would have me sign the damn thing on the back. Unbelievable. I didn't understand that. But I got the pounds, shillings, and pence out, and I really enjoyed England. Like you wouldn't believe, I had two children there. Anyway, make a long story short, we were assigned to the 514th Fighter Interceptor Squadron, one of the three squadrons of the wing. And this were all stationed at RAF Station Manson, except we had one squadron up at Bentwaters. And it eventually went to Schusterberg, I think it was, but where it went, didn't matter, that was after. We had gone down to rocketry at Wheelis Air Force Base in Libya, and I learned all about Islamic living and what have you from Wheelis going around there. I made the mistake of taking a picture of a, it looked like the thief of Baghdad, you know. Oh, I don't know what he was, but I took his picture, and the next thing I know, he screams, holy murder. And I didn't know what the hell I'd done. I just took his picture, and that was what I had done. I had taken his picture. I captured his soul. So I didn't know any better, but next thing I know, I have about 30 or 40 people around me, and being used to the military, and especially the British military, I was in Libya, in Tripoli, and I was right in front of the seaside there, right next to the British Officers Club. And thank God for that. Because out comes this MP, a military police from the British Air Force, Army, and he says, I said, Governor, he says, you having a bit of trouble here? I said, yes. I took this man's picture, and I didn't ask his permission or anything like this. I didn't think I was doing anything. He says, oh, you have to know how to handle these blighters. So I said, fine, you take over. He dispersed the crowd. He told him to get out of there, and that was the end of that. I went in and had a drink with the man, and I don't drink. And I was so grateful for the assistance, you know, because I had seen some weird things from the Islamics, the Arabs. they would look, we were flying against rocketry, against a rag that they had behind the bomber. The bomber would go out and fly in rectangular circles so that we could go and fire from the radar on this rag. And anyway, make a long story short, that when the rag would fall down, sometimes it would float, and it would float over the base, and sometimes part of it would hang over the fence, and the Arabs would try to steal it, because anything they could get is money in the bank. So anyway, make a long story short, we got so well proficient with rocketry that they made us what they call combat ready. When we went back to England, they decided that the 514th and the 513th, our sister squadron on the base, were combat ready, and we would take our share of the load for alerts. Now, we shared that alert with the British, the RAF. Now, in the case of Manston, first of all, let me explain. Manston is on the Thames Estuary, on the tip, just north of Dover, but on the Thames Estuary. And we could see France, about 18 miles on a clear day, which wasn't very often, but we could see it. So we decided to set up shop on the end of the runway on the side. Now, Manston has a 750-foot wide runway. It was made for recovery of bombers that were shot up during the war. And boy, they had plenty of, they had a FIDO system, they had everything that you could possibly have. The FIDO system would burn the fog off. It would lift the fog up 300-400 feet. That'd give you a hell of a lot of visibility. So it was really the perfect base for an all-weather fighter. Anyway, it was my turn to go and be a alert pilot. Now, mind you, I was just a lieutenant. I was not very long in the Air Force. I had maybe a year or two underneath me. We had rocketry, and we were combat ready. So the next thing I know, we're out there on the alert shack, two airplanes, myself and my wingman, were there next to each other, and we had a rule. First one to the airplane was lead in this particular case. Anyway, sure enough, we got the clocks in the scramble order. They said, get to your planes, get airborne, and check in on whatever the frequency was. It's not important. Roger, we beat that 5 minutes in about 3 minutes at least. And we were on the end of the runway. I was taking off. I was no sooner got airborne. Now, mind you, we took off as a formation of two, but because of our tactics in radar, one drops behind the other, and we go in line. And then as we reach the target, whatever the target is, we turn in place so that both of us have a chance to fire on the same thing. Well, at any rate, when I checked into GCI, they said, I have some information for you. I said, I hope so. He says, you are ordered to fire on this object. It's a UFO that's orbiting Ipswich and Norwich, which is on the East Anglia. And it's just stationary sometimes. We don't understand it. It's at Angels 320. So, and it said, go gate, which means you're after Pernod, just go get him. So we got out there, and mind you, he wasn't lying. We were in the soup immediately. I don't think I ever saw a single light after we got airborne, because I was in that soup, and he vectored us to north 020, which is kind of back. So we turned around. We were probably over France by this time. And then we turned around and started heading and climbing. I was climbing as fast as the airplane would go using the afterburner. And my fuel was going fast, because you know, when you use that afterburner, the fuel disappears. Anyway, he said, I'll give you an intern, and you'll have on your port side at 30 degrees, somewhere around 15 miles away, you'll have your target. Sure enough, just like he said, we turned. I saw a blip that was as big as the blips I saw. So when I'd see an aircraft carrier in the North Sea, of course, I couldn't see anything. I could get it on the radar. But and the radar was so sensitive that it was like a blob of light. It wasn't a point. It was a blob. So when I ran my range gate marker up to this blip, it just seemed to lock on and turn all the lights off. It was such a strong lock on that the airplane was telling me where to go. I mean, just in every way. So sure enough, I called Judy, and that was the symbol that we used for GCI to say, you don't need to give me any more information. I'm locked on, and that my radar will take me for this thing. Well, I was still at 0.92, and fuel was going down fast. And I said, I want to come out of afterburner. I said, no, stay in afterburner. I was really worried about my fuel. Anyway, they denied that. They wanted me to get this thing down. So as I was going in, I got this lock on, and I had overtakes that weren't very high. But I was going 0.92 Mach, which is 92% of Mach 1, which is very fast, very close to 700 miles an hour. At any rate, when I locked on, that it was such a strong lock with strong information. I was getting all kinds of information from my radar. It was telling me everything. So I called Judy and started going in on the thing, and he still had to tell me some more. Straight ahead, just keep going, you're on the way. I said, I know that. Anyway, when I got my 20 seconds to go, the circle starts shrinking. On the circle, you have overtake speed. The overtake was indicating I was going 0.92, and this thing was probably pretty near still because he wasn't moving, because it was about that much closure speed. As I was getting closer, I noticed that my radar was basically so damn strong that I could see all the lights that were coming on. And what was going on was he had decided to get the hell out of there. And when he got out of there, he went Mach 10 or something. It was beyond anything I could measure. So, I mean, he left me just standing there, and he was gone. And this happened in maybe 1 or 2 seconds. And you know, at my speed, there's nothing I could do. That was it. It was all over for me. I told the radar people. I said, GCI. I said, what's happening with this bogey? He says, I'm sorry, sir, but he's off our screen. He has a 250-mile range scope, and he was already off of that screen as well. So I said, there's nothing I can do. I can't do anything except fire rockets, and then they'll land on Ipswich, and I don't want to do anything like that. So he said, well, you're released to home plate, meaning I could go home. On the way home, they called me and said, when you get on the ground, call me on the landline. I've got to give you a briefing. I said, Roger, I'd like to know what the hell happened too. So anyway, I got on the ground. I called them. This med sector was RAF controlled. This is the MOD that called the shots. And at any rate, they said, this mission has been declared top secret, and you're not to mention this to anyone, not your commander, not your wife, not anybody. Mum's the word, you didn't fly this mission. You understand? I said, yes, sir, I understand. He said, now we're sending somebody down from the embassy to debrief you. What they meant is they're sending me a spook. A spook is what we used to call these people that come from the cloak and dagger and debrief you and, you know, tell you that you're in jeopardy of anything if you do anything. So when I got down there, the next morning, the spook showed up. I didn't see him. An innocent man that has been in contact with me since, because he didn't know about the mission either. But nobody knew about the mission until the MOD released it in October 21st of last year. When they released it, it just took all the weight off my shoulder. And now I could talk to anybody. So I talked to Ron Kane, who's an enlisted man. He was one of two twins. One of them passed away. Both of them were in our operations. And he said, hey, I took that guy back to you. I said, I didn't know anybody knew about him. He came and went like a spook. You know, like nobody saw him. So he said, yeah, I saw him. I can tell you all you want to know about him. I said, I want to know where he was from. He said, we don't know. Thank you very much. But I knew when they held up that USA document that he had, that it was the American Eagle, and it was that I should shut up. And he told me, this is not only top secret. If you open your mouth about this to anyone, whether it be your commander or anyone else, we will take you away from flying for the rest of your career. And I just couldn't see that. So I jammed my two lips together and never said another word. And I left Manston. All my fighter buddies would love to have heard the story. And I would love to have told them, but I couldn't tell them. So I never said another word until the MOD has released it. Now I can talk to them about it. It's about time. That was the end of my mission. That was the end of my... But I'm going to tell you right now, I have convinced myself that this was an alien spacecraft because he did things that my airplane couldn't do or no other airplane could do. And he had speeds that were infinite compared to what I could handle. And I think he had a propulsion system that was controlled anti-gravity or something because he just took off. I don't know how the hell he did it without being plastered up against the ceiling because there were G-forces going on there that I couldn't even imagine. So I have been convinced since then that was an alien and nobody's going to talk me out of that one. I did it myself. And I thank you for your...
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I really don't know how you can follow an account like that. You have just been privileged to sit through a first-person description of arguably one of the most interesting UFO cases that I've ever heard about. 1957, bear in mind we're talking about. A radar return showing a craft the size of an aircraft carrier, capable of hovering at one moment and then accelerating away at speeds of Mach 10 at the next. I sure as heck don't know what that could be. It certainly wasn't one of ours. I wish it was. Absolutely extraordinary. The interesting thing is there's a wider issue here. There have been other cases where serving military pilots having received authorization from the chain of command have been given a shoot-down order. I think Richard Dolan touched yesterday very briefly on the case of Parviz Jafari from Iran in 1976, who was ordered to shoot down a UFO in the vicinity of Tehran. When he closed on the object, everything else in his airplane worked, but I think it was his fire control system, his air-to-air missile firing capability just winked out. Parviz Jafari retired as a general. There are generals out there willing to talk about the UFO issue and about first-person experiences. Another case is Comandante Huertas from Peru, 1980, in December. He was scrambled, authorized to open fire on a UFO that had infringed into restricted military airspace. He actually did manage to open fire with his machine cannon. His testimony was that the rounds were somehow absorbed by the UFO. He said, "I didn't miss." You know, like all fighter pilots, proud men, he said, "I didn't miss." You know. Nor did I see the rounds ricochet off this thing. They were absorbed. He said that's the only word I can use. There is mainstream media coverage of this. Major Torres was interviewed widely. And this whole issue of incidents where pilots have been scrambled to intercept UFOs tracked on radar and given orders to open fire was covered, for example, recently on America's Newsroom on Fox News. So the big channels are beginning to take a look at this subject, and I'm in the second part of my presentation, I'm going to perhaps touch a little bit on changes that I have noticed in the way in which the mainstream media are beginning to engage on this UFO issue. But I want to return now to the ongoing situation in the United Kingdom, where I feel that the British are leading the way, both in terms of governmental action to release our archive of UFO files, and indeed in terms of the events themselves, because Britain has had, as I'm going to go on and explain, a series of extremely interesting UFO incidents in the last year or so. And I'm going to briefly touch on that, but I want, and Steve Bassett specifically asked that I perhaps leave some time for questions at the end. So I'm going to go through these sort of reasonably quickly. But on 8th of June 2008, there was a reported near miss between a UFO and a police helicopter near an Air Force base called RAF St. Athan in South Wales. Reports of what happened varied, but basically one media report suggested that the pilots then chased this UFO across the Bristol Channel. The police themselves confirmed that a UFO had been seen by the air crew. They denied that a chase had taken place. There's a lot of bureaucratic wrangling between the police and the Ministry of Defense over who was going to take the lead on this issue. And there was a wonderful statement given by the Ministry of Defense press office, and one has to wonder quite what they meant by this. But when contacted by one journalist, the quote was, "It is certainly not advisable for police helicopters to go chasing what they think are UFOs." Which was reminiscent, actually, of something that the MOD wrote in something called Project Condyne, a highly classified, secret UK eyes only, study commissioned by the Defence Intelligence Staff, published now, declassified and published on the MOD website. Like all the incidents I'm discussing, this is not just our say-so. This is on the government's own website. It was reminiscent of a recommendation at the back. We changed, by the way, the word UFO. We banned it because we felt it had too much baggage associated with it. And we referred to UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. And one of the recommendations at the back of this secret UK Eyes Only report said, pilots encountering UAP should take no action other than to try to place the object astern. Get out the way. Don't mess with it. Whatever it is. And we don't know, honestly. We don't. I know some of you there will probably disagree, but my best perception is we don't know. I don't know, certainly, what these things are. But they're sure as heck interesting. June 2008, another incident. Some soldiers at a barracks somewhere called Turn Hill in the county of Shropshire. They're on guard duty. They see a number of UFOs pass directly over the military base. I've seen the footage. It's in the public domain. It's not the most exciting UFO footage I've ever seen, but the fact that it was directly over a military base and videoed by soldiers on their cell phones makes it, whatever you think about UFOs, a defense issue. They then did exactly what the standard operating procedure says that you should do in those circumstances. They phoned the National Daily Press. They phoned the Sun. And I'm going to get on to the Sun in a minute, because the Sun is a big part of this story, Britain's best-selling national daily newspaper. It's a tabloid, but it sets political agendas. It's populist, but when it says something, people take notice. The Sun rang me about this. They showed me the footage. I gave a quote. Like all times when you speak to the papers, you do secretly get this little, "Oh, I'm going to be in the papers tomorrow" kind of thing. I know, it's terrible. Anyway, it got to about 7 o'clock the following morning, and my phone rang, and it was a BBC radio station, and they said, "Oh, we've seen this story in the Sun. Army spot UFOs over Shropshire. Can you do an interview down the line?" I said, "Yeah, sure." Did the interview. The phone rang again. I thought, okay, this is obviously caught someone's attention. Frankie volunteered to go out and get a copy of The Sun so that I could actually see what they were saying. She came back, white as a sheet. It's on the front page. A UFO story as the main banner headline on the front page of Britain's best-selling national newspaper. Can you imagine that happening here? Well, oh, and by the way, I missed a bit. The police, I'm just going back to the police helicopter near miss. They used another phrase, which I like. They didn't like referring to the UFO as a UFO. So they said there was a sighting of, quote, an unusual aircraft, unquote. I love it. Sometimes you have to look at the words used. Incidentally, it later emerged that near miss between the police helicopter and the UFO over Wales was not the only near miss involving a police helicopter that year. Back on 2nd of May, there had been another incident. Again, I don't know what the police have done to upset the UFOs, but there seem to be an awful lot of incidents involving police helicopters in the UK at the moment. And this second incident happened actually over Birmingham, which is our second most populous city in the UK. So we had this near miss. And again, you can read about this on the website of a body called the Airprox Board. Airprox stands for Air Proximity, and it's jointly sponsored by the Ministry of Defense and the Civil Aviation Authority, which is our equivalent of your FAA. So this is an official report, and it's talking about a UFO sighting, and it's confirming that the pilot had to take evasive action. These are serious issues in our skies. Fast forward to 2009. I'm just going to run through a couple of news stories, and then I think we're doing pretty well for time, so we may have a lot of time for questions, which could be fun. On 1st of January 2009, the UFO project where I worked formally moved from Whitehall, MOD main building headquarters in London, to Headquarters Air Command at RAF High Wycombe. There was no particular significance in that move, but again, it was covered by some of the national newspapers, and it was my hope, although sadly this hope has not thus far materialized, it was my hope that embedding the UFO project at what is essentially a military headquarters, as opposed to a much more mixed civil-military building, was going to ensure that UFO sightings were investigated with a little bit more rigor, that people didn't make assumptions based on their belief system, but in proper military ways went through, investigated properly, checked what's on radar, etc., etc. That was really the first British UFO story of 2009. It was all a little bit quiet, and then something happened which made news all around the world. On 3rd of January, the residents of a small town in Lincolnshire called Conisholm, some of them saw strange lights in the sky. At about 4 o'clock the following morning, a loud explosion, like a crashing sound, was heard. Now, Conisholm is known, it's home to one of these wind farms where you get all these big wind turbines. They're about 280 feet high, three blades on each of them. Each blade is about 66 feet in length. They're pretty sturdy things. When the locals woke up, they found one of these things had been smashed up. The implication was that something had hit this thing. One of the blades was fine. One of them had been dented out of shape, and one had been knocked off. Again, the son phoned me up, told me about this incident. I gave a quote. UFO hits wind turbine. Front page. Main banner headline. Britain's best-selling national daily newspaper. Twice a UFO story on the front page. In just a few months. that story, perhaps because it was so soon after the Christmas and New Year break, but it something about it captured the imagination, not just of the public, but other media. I did lots of television interviews. The story went all around the world. It prompted... the Sun are well known for some classic headlines, and they sometimes have a little bit of fun with this. They printed a number of follow-up stories, one of the damage at the wind farm, and they ran the headline Farmageddon. But my favorite one, given that this was a wind turbine that had been damaged, was the follow-up story headlined Close Encounters of the Turbine. Now, it's interesting. There was mention, I think, of Terry Hansen yesterday, author of Missing Times, and I know Terry and others in the field feel there's a difficulty, a problem, about getting the mainstream media to engage on this issue. I think I came in at the tail end of something Steve Bassett was saying about archiving the number of mainstream media articles about UFOs and noting the almost exponential rise in this in recent months, over the last year or two ago. I know that the UFO apparently seen at the Obama inauguration was another story that that was picked up and ran extensively. The fact that if you had not split the vote by having lots of different UFO-related issues put up in the so-called briefing book, UFOs would have actually been, in terms of popular vote, I believe, the number one story that people wanted to raise with the new administration. That was a story as well. It was covered in England. I don't know what coverage it generated over here, but my point is, and I say this as somebody not just who worked for the government for 21 years, but someone who now actually works as a freelance journalist. I write feature articles myself for national newspapers, magazines. I pitch stories for news shows, chat shows. I am noticing that it is not impossible, in fact it is actually quite possible, and I've done it, as have others, to get this subject covered, and actually covered not just, we had a joke about those headlines, but essentially the story was played straight. And other TV news shows, both in America and in Britain, have covered it too. I mentioned America's Newsroom. I think What was it? ABC Nightline did a UFO feature. I think there are a couple of other big ones in the pipeline that I know have been recorded and haven't aired yet. Australia, actually, this Sunday, watch out for this. Channel 7, a big news show called Sunday Night. They do three stories in a one-hour show. One of them's going to be a UFO story, played very straight. They're going to look at the Bentwaters case. They're going to look at a couple of other British cases, the release of the MOD's UFO files. Are they going to play this in a light-hearted way or seriously? I hope seriously. I actually wrote the story brief for this. So it's possible, it's quite possible to actually get this subject picked up by major news networks and newspapers. Steve, in his introduction, mentioned my op-ed in the New York Times. And again, I think the door is open. It's just a question of whether you want to push it or kick it. Couple of other stories to mention from the UK. I'll finish off the wind turbine story, by the way. They took a residue from one of the blades to Germany to be forensicated by the German manufacturers. They came back, we were told that there would be a response within a few days. About a month later, the response came back, and it said, well, we can't find any evidence of anything exotic having collided with this. Maybe it was mechanical failure. We don't know. There was an interesting postscript, though. The Sun, in running one of their follow-up stories on this, spoke to some people, and I don't know who they are, but the quote used was MOD insiders. And they had apparently suggested that something called Taranis, a prototype drone, something like Predator, might have been responsible. You can go on to British Aerospace, BAE Systems website, and put in the term Taranis, and you'll see there is some information about the program. The interesting thing about that, as I well know from my 21 years MOD experience, is that in the normal course of business, getting people thinking and speculating about prototype aircraft and drones is the very last thing that you would want to do. So isn't it interesting that these defense insiders, whoever they were, arguably tried to defuse a UFO story by putting our focus on the very thing they're normally running a mile from? That is interesting. At the end of January, David Cameron, leader of the Conservative Party in the United Kingdom, possibly a man who will be the next Prime Minister of Britain, was asked at a Q&A session, what are you going to do about the UFO issue? This issue can be taken into the highest of political realms and put on the agenda. He was slightly caught out, I suspect, by the question, but he responded that he saw certainly no reason why information on this should be kept secret, and essentially committed himself to being as open as possible on the UFO situation. And I'm sure that comment will come back to haunt him in later years. The Ministry of Defense released figures a couple of weeks ago to show that last year they had received, and bear in mind, the MOD, because of their fairly lukewarm attitude to the UFO issue these days, are not really people's first port of call in terms of reporting a UFO sighting. They received 285 reports in 2008, it's been revealed, more than double the figure for 2007. So again, that doubling of UFO sightings in the last year, again, made the news in a big way in the United Kingdom. And just 3 weeks ago, the Ministry of Defense released the third batch of UFO files and sent them to the National Archives. So these are extremely exciting times in the UK at the moment. I think I'm well ahead of time, actually. So what I'm going to do now is perhaps wrap this up and then allow a fairly meaty Q&A session for as long as Milton and I can keep going before Steve and Cheryl drag us from the stage. So thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. I don't know how you're going to work this, but I guess, same as before, that someone's going to put a microphone down there and address a question either to Dr. Torres or to myself, and we will do our best to respond. So if somebody has somebody's just coming up with a microphone, so if you want to form an orderly queue, and we'll do what we can.
Mr. Pope, you made a comment during your presentation about a UFO being seen during the Obama inauguration.
Yes.
Where was the UFO? In the United States, United Kingdom, and when did it happen?
This was, correct me if I'm wrong, this was a piece of CNN footage, and on one of the news reports, covering the inauguration, the camera panned around, I think, over a crowd of people, and something just flashed across the screen. Now, it may be a bird. I don't know. There's a lot of talk. I think the best thing I can recommend on this is literally go to YouTube, put in the search terms Obama inauguration and UFO, and just sort by relevance or something. But you'll see there's a lot of discussion about this. It's I mean, it's a blink and you miss it kind of piece of footage. But the fact that it was picked up and led to such a discussion and debate was I think interesting and shows people's appetite for this subject. But that's really all I know. What I don't know is whether anyone from the UFO community in the US has actually approached CNN and asked them for the original footage, because without that original footage, I'm not sure that there's much that can be achieved. But yeah, that's the story as I know it.
You said they would begin the release of the files in Britain in three batches, starting 3 years, starting in May of 2008 was the first release, and here we are about close to May of 2009. So I assume that we've only released perhaps one third of the files so far. Is that correct? And second, just aren't we, even though we have all these files released, that doesn't tell us anything about the most important cases, which may be still be kept secret.
I think you're about right. We're probably about a third of the way through the release process. I think when we get to more modern times, we're going to find that actually a lot of the files are just FOI requests. So at the tail end of the process, in terms of the interesting material, things will tail off. What I would say about the material, to take your second point, that's been released, it's a mixed bag. Many of the cases, in fact, I would go so far as to say most of them in percentage terms are extremely mundane, and they are clearly just lights in the sky that are almost certainly misidentifications of all the usual things, aircraft lights, satellites, meteors, etc., etc. But it is a case of going through literally, and by the way, there are 160 files. Each file can contain 500 or 600 individual documents. So we are talking tens of thousands of documents. It's a question of wading through. And like I said, you'll go through man walking his dog sees light in sky, and then suddenly you'll hit a case like the case of Dr. Torres. There isn't in these files, and I hate using this phrase, but it's become a bit of a soundbite. There isn't a spaceship in a hangar type smoking gun. I mean, I've seen these files, and there isn't. But there are plenty of cases where we've got structured craft performing speeds and maneuvers that we can't match. We've got plenty of cases involving these things being seen by police officers, pilots, military personnel, where we've got near misses between UFO and commercial aircraft. So, no one should expect that the last file is going to be opened and it's going to say, yeah, you know, we had a spaceship in an Air Force base all along, and we just didn't tell you. That ain't going to be there. But you will have, in the public domain, an awful lot more interesting UFO cases, and I think we've heard one today, that we didn't have before.
Mr. Pope, I didn't get the name that you said there was a top-secret project, Eyes Only, and I didn't get the pronunciation of that.
It's called Project Condign, C-O-N-D-I-G-N. Okay. But if you go onto the Ministry of Defense website, mod.uk, and just put in the phrase UAP, you will find that. And it's about 450 pages. And again, you've got to do a lot of wading through, but it's well worth a look.
One other question, sir. I'm sorry I missed the first half of your lecture. Did you discuss Bentwaters at all?
I didn't discuss Bentwaters. That would be a whole other presentation. I mean, suffice to say, I think it's certainly one of the UK's most compelling UFO cases. It is a case that is going to be covered on Sunday night on this Channel 7 broadcast. The program's actually called Sunday Night. You'll be able to see it, I think. You'll be able to watch it on the website. And I know that some other material that won't make the final broadcast, for example, lengthier interviews with myself, with Colonel Charles Holt and things, should be available on the website.
I'm sure you've heard of our wonderful New York Times, you know, all the news that we think fits will print. They called it a guy driving an old Dodge truck with its lights on. And the Tucson Skeptics Society implied that it was a radioactive police car that flies up and down. So we still have our share of idiocy here.
There are indeed some fairly bizarre skeptical theories doing the rounds about the Bentwaters case. I mean, suffice to say, the defense intelligence staff, their own assessment of the radiation levels taken at the landing site were that they seemed, and this is a direct quote from the document, significantly higher than background, quote unquote. You know, again, I don't have time to go into all the details of it, but it's a fascinating case, and I hope it's going to be given a reasonable treatment on the Sunday Night show this weekend. But of course, it's been covered on UFO Hunters. It's been covered on all sorts of other shows. I mean, on just going back to the New York Times. I mean, yes, this is a newspaper that has perhaps not been regarded previously as friendly to this subject. But I approached them last year and asked if I could write an op-ed on this subject, and they said, "What would my angle be?" And I said, "Well, I would stress the defense and air safety issues of this subject, whatever we think UFOs might be." And they said, "Okay." And they commissioned me to do it. So it can be done. And it was certainly not what I guess you would call an exopolitical article. I mean, it was very much concentrating, as I say, on issues of defense, national security, air safety, espionage. But it got the subject into the New York Times. Can be done.
Major Torres. I'm one of those mud guys, U.S. Army, so I'm not a familiar
with... Oh, listen, I got nothing but respect for you guys.
That's all right.
I did everything I could in Vietnam to keep you from getting hurt.
Thank you. Yeah, they didn't ask me if I'd like to mud or not. But my question is... in the recounting of your incident, you mentioned you had a wingman. You had two aircraft.
Yes, I had a wingman, and you know, he was a new guy in the squadron, and he has disappeared. I don't know where. I never got to talk to him again. Right after the flight, he was gone, and I don't know where he went.
Okay, that answers my question.
I worked on the Blackbird in 62 Burbank. We had a drone that went Mach 5.5. The Orion is supposed to be 50% faster than that.
Okay, well, I certainly don't dispute that there are all sorts of prototype drones and aircraft with pretty remarkable categories. I don't think that can really explain Dr. Torres's sighting. But yes, of course, at any given time, there'll be things out there that you won't see at the big air shows for a fair few years. I think that's taken as read.
I have a two-part question. One's for you, Mr. Pope, and the other one will be for my dad. Now, he kept this secret for me for 35 years, so, you know, I mean, believe me, you guys aren't the only one in the dark here. The question I have for you, Mr. Pope, is, you know, now the disclosure is coming out, and one of the questions is, you know, your particular agency is releasing your documents with the MOD, but what about MI6? What about other entities that are cloak and dagger, even more so than your particular organization? And in retrospect, I mean, everybody was kept in the dark about this banking, and it's just a matter of a hood, nod, and a wink, and it's a trust me issue. And so really, we're given what the governments give us as fodder. It's up to us as individuals to really see through everything that we see and analyze it, because I used to believe everything. I'm a veteran myself, was just like my dad, very absolute devout believer in the Constitution and the government, and the world is shattered, and I no longer trust anybody but that guy right there. And if you can respond to that, then I have a question for him.
My response to that is that certainly I'm not aware of MI5 or MI6 having any remit for the UFO issue. Interestingly, it's the centenary of both those organizations this year, and official histories are being written. But I don't think there's going to be anything on UFOs in there. And your final question for your dad.
Okay. It's a two-part question. Is you didn't actually get into your credentials. I know you mentioned your education. I know it, but most of these folks here don't know where you work.
It's not important.
I think to them it would be important that you work for NASA.
The only thing is I'm not a blithering idiot, that's all.
Yeah. Well, for example, I know you worked with Wernher von Braun in the rocket program. Most people here didn't know that.
I got as close to Wernher von Braun as you did to the President of the United States.
But you were under his watch
at NASA.
Well,
we were there. I worked with NASA.
Okay.
I was the chief of range control just before I retired. When coming back from Vietnam, they offered me a job, which I couldn't turn down, as the chief of range control. Now, range control on Cape Kennedy is the people that do all the scheduling of all the shots, whether they're secret, whether they're not secret, or didn't matter. The only that mattered is the priority, and the priorities usually carried a 1A priority, and that was 90% of NASA going in there. We have a few military secrets that were going, but you know, to tell you about education, just about everybody at the Cape was an engineer of sorts.
Yeah.
So there are very few things going on that we didn't know about and we didn't talk about. And I'll tell you one thing about the government. When you tell them a secret, it's a secret and they're not going to give it back. They're going to keep it forever. That's the way I feel.
The other part was, you mentioned your wingman, because I know you tried to find out who your wingman was.
I know.
Was there any other people that could verify this incident?
Ron Cain. I told you about there was an enlisted man. As a matter of fact, there was two of them. They were twins. They were in an operations section. And when the spook came, he ushered him back to me. And he just, after the MOD released this, he called me and let me know. He said, "Did you know I ushered that spook to you?" I said, "Hell no. I would have been asking you about him then, you know." But that was the first time I even talked to him. I didn't even know he knew him.
But you were also contacted, I believe, by the guy that also had ground radar confirmation he had contacted, because I saw this letter to you, remember? The gentleman wrote you a letter. Maybe you forgot.
I've gotten so many letters.
Yeah, but he was on ground radar, and he confirmed it as well.
There was one that indicated there was a radar system out there where they were able to control your radar, or rather a spook system, to make you think that you were chasing something, but it wasn't there. And that never helped. I don't believe that, and if it did happen, it didn't happen to me.
Okay, so. Thank you.